Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too. In these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart. Don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org and at iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 12th, 2011. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Today my guests are Melissa Bank and Leah Hager-Cohen. First up is Melissa Bank. I'm going to read her little bio, although I want to say so much more about her. She's also the author of The Wonder Spot, a second collection of linked stories. Her work received the Nelson Agron Award for Short Fiction and has been translated into 33 languages. She divides her time between Manhattan and East Hampton, New York. And we are here today to primarily talk about The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing, which has been reissued. And I'm so curious about that, Melissa. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good to have you.
Good to be here, always, so to speak.
Always great to talk with you. Talk about this reissue.
I think the sort of driving force behind it is actually, that's my dog, is actually the series that uses tattoo artists to illustrate the covers. Mm-hmm. And so I think it coincided with the 10-year anniversary of Girl Guide being published.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an amazing thing to actually get a book reissued. You know, I go to bookstores and you try not to look on the shelf to see if my book is there. and it's just, it's wonderful because it gives it, you know, another little life and the chance that other people might read it. And cool. I think especially in this case that it was, I think, probably they were really hoping that a younger audience would get to it because it was sort of a moment when it came out, and I think they were just hoping that it would somehow reach this group that were just, you know, 10 years old at that time.
Well, I think the cover is beautiful. It's I didn't realize it was part of that series.
Yeah, I think it's called Penguin Ink.
Mm-hmm.
And so, thank you, Penguin Ink.
Yeah, it's beautiful, beautiful. Well, you know, I'm curious about the fact that, like, on the cover it says fiction, mm-hmm. and if you read on, you see that it's stories. And,
yeah.
You know, there's always this taboo or something about publishing collections of short stories as opposed to novels.
Mm-hmm.
And can you talk about that at all? I mean, I never thought of The Girl's Guide when it came out as being stories, a
mm-hmm.
collection of stories. It always seemed like a novel, maybe because they are interconnected.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that for me, I think it's a little bit on the publisher's part, not particularly Penguin, but publishers, plural, rather than, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Anyway, that, you know, the idea is that stories are more like poems. They're more literary, and they're going to be harder to sell. And there, I can sort of understand in certain collections how it is hard to read a collection of unrelated stories, just because you're in and you're with those characters and in that story, and then it's over, and it's really over. It's just this many pages, and then it's over. Whereas with linked stories, I think you keep on living with those characters. But for me, structurally, I mean, the way I think I was thinking of it, if I was thinking of it, would be that we tell the stories of our lives. We don't tell our lives like a novel. And unless, I mean, except for maybe, you know, people with grandiose delusions, it doesn't really naturally go that way. But the real reason why neither book is a novel is that I don't know how to write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you told me I was writing a novel, I would just stop and take the dog for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
It's is too intimidating.
So when you were writing this collection, were you thinking, okay, I'm going to keep this character and this story is going to somehow connect to the next? Or were you thinking, what were you thinking?
You know, I wasn't thinking that way at all. I'm really an intuitive writer rather than somebody who mm-hmm. elaborately sets up a wonderful architecture. Everything for me is really kind of done by the unconscious, not by the planner or organizer or architect. I, in fact, have no foresight, so I couldn't write that way. I think that that what I was hoping for each time I sat down to write was to write a story. And it wasn't until I was about three-quarters of the way finished that I realized I had a book, and I saw how it did fit together. And I did write the last stories with that in mind, understanding that it was all a body of work. And I think the second book, sort of similar in that I wanted each story to kind of stand on its own. And even though I knew I was writing a book, I didn't worry about having what I think you need to have in a novel, possibly, which is a big idea,
mm-hmm.
you know, some
mm-hmm.
overarching, large thing to say. I feel like maybe in the end it turns out I have large things to say, but I'm only going to get to them sort of one tiny detail at a time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Melissa Bank. And we're talking about The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing, published by Penguin, reissued by Penguin Inc. One of the things I love about your writing is your voice, and I've said it before. It's just such a wonderful voice, and you know, in getting to know you, it's also sort of you. And yeah. I heard something. I was trying to find who said it, which is, if you want to change your voice, change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of a hard thing to get your head around, you know, change your life and your voice will change. But it's sort of true. Your voice seems to be a product of yourself, your life. So I'm guessing that the voice of these stories that you're writing was not a part of any challenge in writing the stories.
No, it's not true, actually, because, oddly enough, I know that my writing reads as sort of all of a piece, and maybe what connects it is my voice. For each story, I'm always looking for the voice of the story, and it sounds odd to say, but we kind of use voice as shorthand for a lot of things, and one of those things is, what is the narrator's relationship to this story? What is her attitude to the story? When is it? At what point is she telling the story? Is it in the present tense and it's all being uncovered moment by moment, or is it in the past tense after something has been learned? It's really, I think, a number of things that come together, but I feel like the real question is not how you find your voice, but how you find your voice over and over and over again. Because if you are a writer, I think that, you know, you come to it as a kind of, you sit down to the page every day as kind of a novice. And so I wish that any lesson that I learned from writing sort of helped me out in the next draft. But really, it's new to me all the time.
Hmm. Are you a disciplined writer? Do you sit and just stay at the desk until you have a certain number of pages done or a certain, you know, whatever prescribed amount of work done? Or are you doing it in fits and starts? Or how does it go for you?
Well, I have to say, I do sit down every day now. I didn't always. And my life changed so much after Girl's Guide that the way I wrote and my discipline and patterns and compulsions changed also. I mean, so when I wrote Girl's Guide, I worked in advertising during the day, and then I wrote at night. And after the book was sold, I was able to quit my day job. And so I had then the chance to write all the time. Which is tricky, because in a way, if you're not writing well, there's no sort of end of the day for you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sort of when you throw up your arms or hands, whatever you throw up, you throw up is the point. It's sickening. So, I mean, I sort of am always learning what is going to work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually thinking at this moment of renting a little office or a studio, so I actually get to leave the apartment,
mm-hmm.
and my home is not my workplace.
Right.
Which seems really, really exciting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been thinking the same thing, just to get away from the distractions and the things, you know, oh yeah, I got to do that, and the phone's ringing.
And also just, yeah, to make a commitment to sitting down.
Right.
I mean, I can do that somewhat, but I actually feel like, you know, if you go somewhere else, you have a commitment to being there. You
mm-hmm.
cannot, you can't just forget about writing and clean the house.
Right, right. Well, can you, will you read a little bit?
Sure.
A few couple pages from The Girl's Guide?
Sure. I'm going to read from the very beginning.
Yeah.
This is the story called advanced beginners. My brother's first serious girlfriend was 8 years older, 28 to his 20. Oh, my God, this dog.
That's all right.
I'm sorry. my brother's first serious girlfriend was 8 years older, 28 to his 20. Her name was Julia Cathcart, and Henry introduced her to us in early June. They drove from Manhattan down to our cottage in Loveladies on the New Jersey shore. When his little convertible, his pet, pulled into the driveway, she was behind the wheel. My mother and I were watching from the kitchen window. I said, "He lets her drive his car." My brother and his girlfriend were dressed alike, baggy white shirts tucked into jeans, except she had a black cashmere sweater on over her shoulders. She had dark eyes, high cheekbones, and beautiful skin, pale with high coloring in her cheeks, like a child with a fever. Her hair was back in a loose ponytail, tied with a piece of lace. She wore tiny pearl earrings. I thought maybe she'd look older than Henry, but it was Henry who looked older than Henry. Standing there, he looked like a man. He'd grown a beard, for starters, and had on new wire-rimmed sunglasses that made him appear more like a bon vivant than a philosophy major between colleges. His hair was longer, and not yet lightened by the sun. It was the reddish-brown color of an Irish setter. He gave me a kiss on the cheek, as though he always had. Then he roughed around with our Airedale, Atlas, while his girlfriend and mother shook hands. They were clasping fingertips, ladylike, smiling as though they were already fond of each other and just waiting for details to fill in why. Julia turned to me and said, "You must be Janie." "Most people call me Jane now," I said, making myself sound even younger. "Jane," she said, possibly in the manner of an adult trying to take a child seriously. Henry unpacked the car and loaded himself up with everything they'd brought, little bags and big ones, a string tote, and a knapsack. As he started up the driveway, his girlfriend said, "Do you have the wine, Hank?" Whoever Hank was, he had it.
That was Melissa Bank reading from The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing. I love that story. It's such a great way to start this book too. And was that the story that won the prize? Is that why
no,
it began?
No. The story that won the prize was the one that I think is called My Old Man.
Mm-hmm.
And this story was actually the last story I wrote for the book after the book had already been sold. So I kind of was writing, you know, the beginning, mm-hmm. and which was really daunting because I know how I shop for books in a bookstore. I read the first page.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was trying to make that first page be good enough, and actually no first page can be that, you know. If you're looking at it, you really can't start, you know, if you're looking at it from the outside, it's pretty much impossible to write.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to ask you about a quote in one of your stories that a friend of mine, Tina, wrote to me about this morning and said it was like one of the most, if not the most, I don't know, moving quotes that she's ever read in a novel or short story. And it is, "We are all children until our fathers die."
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from?
God, I don't know. I mean, I have thought about it many times, and I think that something that I've said, you know, myself now, even to kind of really adult children, when their parents die and they're 50 and it can still feel devastating. I think as long as there's someone in the world who feels that way about you, feels about you as a child, you can be a child.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also some sense possibly of kind of an overriding, you know, goodwill or unconditional love. And once you lose that parent, I think you really realize that you're not actually protected by anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so true. Hey, okay. Wanted to ask you also about it's something, your similes. You have this thing that you just, you know, simile metaphors is a difficult, it's difficult in writing fiction, writing memoir, and yours are original, and I wonder if you sit and think about what something's like before they come to you, or if they just come to you. Like, for instance, in what you read, she had dark eyes, high cheekbones, and beautiful skin, pale with high coloring in her cheeks, like a child with a fever. How did that, like a child with a fever, come? Does it do? Do you have a certain ease with simile and metaphor? Do they just, does it just occur to you, or are you sitting there?
I'm teaching a memoir class right now, so we've been talking about this kind of thing a lot, and I have some really good students, and one of them was able to. For me, the best, most evocative detail is actually taken from the physical world, but if you lift it to write about it, it becomes really interesting. Like in his story, he'd written something like he'd moved from, his parents were from St. Louis, and he said that that they were, you know, it took moving 1,000 miles away to realize that there were 1,000 miles, that they were 1,000 miles apart when they were all under the same roof. And somehow but the physical detail that he noticed was whenever he called his parents, they were in a different room in the house. They were in different rooms, even when they were watching the same TV show. So that kind of detail, see, I actually love when it's not a strain, when you're actually saying how something was, and it has a kind of evocative or metaphorical power by just being what it is. And I really work on, I try to, you know, I spend a lot of time revising, and really it's there that I may have an idea of something, or I want to get the description right, but it's really in the refining of it that I kind of reach, what I'm after.
So you are revising a lot.
I revise a lot.
Yeah. Because you're writing. I mean, you look at it. Some of these stories, some of the lines look so simple, and it's sort of like all the writers we know of whose writing looks so simple and was so worked over to make it appear so.
I mean, the writing, I love writing that looks effortless. In fact, I think it's really great, you know, as a young writer or as an emerging writer to read things that make it look easy. That stuff is what takes the most work and most revision, sort of not having the wrong kind of ambiguity, not making anybody ever strain outside the story. Like, I don't want to read and I don't want to write stories that are about talent or virtuosity. I'm just not that interested in that.
Right.
And, you know, I can appreciate it, but it's not what, as a human being, I'm hungry for. I don't want anybody to be dazzled by a phrase at the expense of the story I'm trying to tell.
Yeah.
You know?
We're at the end of our time, and I wonder if you just have any advice you've received along the way that has stuck with you and has been helpful in particular.
God, that's a great question. You know, the only thing that comes to mind is from Somerset Maugham, and that is there are only 3 rules to write a novel, but nobody knows what they are. That seems truest.
That's pretty true.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks
thank
again
you.
For spending time with me here. And as always, I just love your stuff, and I'm enjoying rereading this book again. So,
Barbara, thank you so much.
You're welcome. That's Melissa Bank. Her books are The Wonder Spot and the reissue of The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing, which I love. It's and the cover is indeed beautiful. And what else can I tell you? I am actually listening to it on tape, and she's reading it. and it is on tape. It's on a tape cassette that I found, I don't know when, a few years ago when she was on. And I love it because she's reading the stories. And like that, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we should have Leah Hager Cohen with us, whose novel is The Grief of Others. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, the only weekly news commentary radio broadcast that features a dog named Mahler. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a Bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
Opinions and views expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about the show or other programs on KUCI, please log on to KUCI.org for the latest program schedule.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We broadcast from the University of California Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. I continue to be Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We spent our first half with Melissa Bank, and we're back with Leah Hager Cohen. Before we go on, though, let me just say, if you want to know more about Leah, you can go to her website, which is the spelling of her name, and there's lots of stuff to find there. You can also listen to the show or direct your friends to listen to the show in the future when it's podcast. And we podcast just about all of the shows that broadcast, and they go up maybe a week or two, sometimes three later. You can find them by going to my website, penonfire.com, or directly to the blog, which is writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And there's a little search box in the upper left-hand corner. And if there's an author you're looking for, you can enter his or her name in that box. And if we've done a show and you've spelled the name right, it will come up. And lots of great shows. Shows with Melissa Bank. She's been on a few times before today. You can find shows with her. Billy Collins, James Fry, Danny Shapiro, on and on. Anyway, we're here to talk to Leah about the grief of others. And she has written 4 nonfiction books, including Train Goes Sorry and Glass, Paper Beans, and 4 novels, including House Lights and The Grief of Others, which we're going to talk about today. She serves as the Jenks Chair in Contemporary American Letters at the College of the Holy Cross and teaches in the Low Residency MFA program in creative writing at Lesley University. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review. Hi, Leah.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Oh, talk about your wonderful book. Talk about how this came about, The Grief of Others.
You know, I didn't realize that I was writing a book about grief until I was well into it. So when I started, I really just started with an image of a 10-year-old girl on a bicycle biking toward the river with a pocket full of chicken bones and fireplace ashes. And that's all I knew when I started out, but I knew it was a compelling image and scene. And so I just began to write into that story and realized after a while that what I was dealing with was the grief of a family and of really everyone around them as well, as they come to appreciate in different ways.
Interesting that you say you were writing into a story and that after a while you saw what it was you were writing about. Now, how patient will you be? How long might you spend? How many pages might you go writing into a story before you need to know or before you find out? You know, because writers are very impatient. We're very like, what is this? What am I doing?
I'm getting better as I get older with handling the not knowing. Mm-hmm. And I think when I was younger, the impatience often led me to force a story or force a kind of understanding that I didn't really own. And so I'm much better now at being patient, because I'm so interested in learning as much as I can about circumstances and characters. And I realize that for me, that takes time.
Interesting. Yeah, it does take time. And I think the problem becomes staying in the chair as long as it takes. Yeah.
Well, as most people do, I have lots of things to get me up out of the chair. But mm-hmm. I think that's good, too, because it's often when I'm walking the dog or chopping the vegetables for supper that I'm doing another kind of work on mm-hmm. the book. And then it sort of disposes me well towards sitting back in the chair when next I can.
I'm curious about, well, a few things about The Grief of Others. One is the characters' names. Right from the start, the characters' names seem so perfect for them. I love the name Biscuit. I love that Ricky has sort of a, you know, sort of an androgynous name that sort of fits her and what she does and her role in the family. Talk about coming up with names and how much attention you pay to that, or how they come to you, or your relationship with naming characters.
Well, it's funny that you ask, because I have sort of this embarrassing activity that I loved to do ever since I was a child, which was just spend time browsing through baby name books. I've always been really drawn to gathering and collecting and storing away for later use names. So it's one of the pleasures of writing fiction is getting to name characters. That being said, I don't really know how the right name suggests itself to me, but I do know sometimes when I'm working with a character and it's not quite the right name, and I'll come back later when I've
figured out, you know, what that name really does need to be.
Hmm. Also, in creating suspense, while this is considered literary fiction, I would guess. I mean, you know, I don't think anywhere it says what genre it is, but I read it as literary fiction. There's quite a lot of suspense in the structure and in your novel, in your scenes. And one of the first scenes in the first chapter, actually, one of your characters, Biscuit, gets swept into a river. And she's okay, but it created such a element of suspense for me, and her calamity then brings in another major character. So, you know, from what you just said, I'm guessing you don't plot, but I'm curious how this happened, if you can sort of reconstruct, you know, that scene and how you deal with the element of suspense in writing fiction. Because in literary fiction, it's, you know, it's what keeps you reading. You know, what's going to happen with these characters? What, you know, are they okay? Did they make it through whatever it is?
Well, I think, first of all, I have to tell you a story, which is that my mother has long been an important reader for me. And when she was reading The Grief of Others, it was in galleys, and she was about three quarters of the way through the book, and we were talking on the phone, and she said, "I just want you to know I'm three quarters of the way through. I'm enjoying it, and, you know, I can't wait to finish it and see what happens." And then she paused and she said, "I mean, knowing you, I realize nothing might happen." And it's true. I have not been known for writing stories in which a lot of plot happens. But that being said, I think I have come to understand that if I allow my characters to make bold choices and act on bold choices, it can often move a story forward and serve the unearthing of what's important about that story more than if I keep the action really quiet. So I think that has been something that, as a writer, I've been growing towards. And in that scene that you mentioned where Biscuit sort of falls into the river, sort of gets knocked in by a dog who becomes an important figure, you're right. That moment was important in part because it leads to this other character, Gordy, coming mm-hmm. into her family's life. But it's also important because it's one in a series of events that Biscuit brings about sort of accidentally on purpose in order to try to get noticed and get her family to notice what's amiss within the whole family.
Mm-hmm. This would be a wonderful time to hear you read from The Grief of Others, would you?
Sure. I'll read from the prologue, so I don't need to set it up at all.
Okay.
When he was born, he was alive. That was one thing. He was a he, too, astonishingly. Not that anyone expected him to be otherwise, but the notion of one so elemental, so small, carrying the complex mantle of gender, seemed preposterous. The designation male, the linguistic equivalent of a false mustache fixed above his infant lip. His lips, how barely pink they were, the pink of the rim of the sky at winter dusk. And in their curl, in the way the upper lip rose to peaks and dipped down again twice like a bobbing valentine, and in the way the lower bowed out, luxuriant, lush, as if sated already from a lifetime of pleasures, how improbably expressive were his lips. His hands, like sea creatures, curled and stretched, as if charged with purpose and intent. Five of his fingers closed around one of his mother's and held it while he slept. He was capable of this. His toenails, specks of abalone. The whorls of his ears were as marvelously convoluted as any Escher drawing. the symmetry precise, the lobes little as teardrops, soft as peaches. The darkness of the ear hole, a portal to the part of him that wasn't there, that hadn't fully formed, that spelled his end. His mother had been led to believe that the whole vault of his skull would be missing, raw nerve tissue gruesomely visible beneath a window of membrane. She'd pictured a soft-boiled egg in an egg cup, the top removed, the yolk gleaming and exposed. She'd braced herself for protuberant eyes, flattened nose, folded ears, cleft palate, the features of an anencephalic infant. But the opening in his skull was no bigger than a silver dollar, and all his features lovely. She believed at first, triumphantly, that the diagnosis had been made in error, that now the doctors, seeing the baby, would be forced to downgrade their diagnosis to something less serious, still severe, perhaps, but not lethal. He was out of the womb and alive in the world for 57 hours, a tally that put him in rare statistical company and caused in his mother an absurd sense of pride, during which time she kissed his ears and insteps and toes and palms and knuckles and lips repeatedly, a lifetime of kisses. She could not bear to let him out of her arms. He belonged to her exclusively, a feeling she had not had when her other children were born. This one was bound to her in ways no one knew, just as she, having hidden his secret these past 4 months, was bound to him. She would let no one else hold him, not even the baby's father, who asked only once, and then, with great and terrible chivalry, pressed her no further. During the hours she held him, she could not make herself believe how fleeting his life would be.
Thank you so much. That was Lee Hager Cohen reading from The Grief of Others, published by Riverhead Books. Wow. That was, you know, I'm thinking of reviews I've read of your book. And one thing I see that reviewers note is that your work is emotional without being sentimental. And you know, I don't know, how do you pull that off? Is this something that you consider as you're writing a scene that you feel is emotional, and are you working against having it come off as sentimental? Not that anything is wrong with sentiment, but it seems to be something a word I see mentioned quite a bit.
You know, I think a little bit about acting, about theater training, which I did a little bit when I was younger, and there was this this truism or this principle that if you're the actor and you're on stage, you know, sobbing hysterically, the audience might read your performance as, you know, oh, that character is sad. But chances are the audience won't be feeling gripped by sobs. Whereas if you're acting in such a way, if you're struggling to suppress sobs, if you're struggling to master the emotion and deliver the experience of that unbearable sadness to the audience members themselves, that it's a much more powerful experience rather than telling the audience what's going on. You're actually creating the emotional experience for them. And so I think there's a similarity in writing. And I aim to create the experience, I hope, in the reader, rather than just have the reader register, you know, oh yeah, that's a sad scene.
Interesting. You have a wonderful blog as well. I spent a little time there, and quite an emotional, actually an emotional post about going for a walk with, I think your son who wanted to photograph stars.
Yeah.
And the entire post was just, was long and wonderful and got me to thinking about blogs and how much you give to blogs. I mean, to blogging, are you keeping whatever you're putting into your writing out of your blog, or don't you care? I mean, are the two interwoven?
Purely in terms of time, when I'm feeling quite overcommitted and ragged about the number of minutes on the clock, that's when I'm less likely to post something on the blog. But aside from that, I feel like the blog and then whatever novel or longer piece of work I might be working on, they really support each other. I think of the blog as a play space, kind of a sandbox. I don't edit carefully what I put on the blog. I post it in a single seating, and then, and then I get up and I move on. And so I feel like the stuff on the blog, it's pretty raw. It's pretty experimental for me, and I think that helps me to stay limber, in a sense, for them, whatever longer writing project I'm working on.
That's interesting. I like that. The blog is a sandbox.
Yeah. And it's great because then it sort of removes a lot of pressure from whatever, little sandcastle that I'm trying to build
right.
there.
Right, sure. Yeah. I like that. I'm going to remember that. And because you just, it's like you want enough there to keep your readers coming back so that you're giving something and not just, promoting whatever you're doing lately, but also it can really cut into your writing time. And, it seems like there's somehow there's a balance there to be found and, worried about having it be grammatically perfect and interesting and can really, again, cut into writing time.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And I like having a place where I leave things unfinished. Mm-hmm. And many of the blog posts feel more like the beginning of an idea.
Yeah.
And that's nice because the beginning of an idea is sort of fuel for endless hours of rumination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm curious because you teach in the Leslie College MFA program, the residency program?
Yes.
How or what advice do you have for writers who would like to go for an MFA but can't for whatever reason? Maybe family, maybe expense, who knows, but would love to, progress their writing as you do in MFA programs.
There are so many more loosely organized and often free opportunities to attend talks, lectures, panel discussions, and also to form a writing group, either to join a writing group that's led by someone or just to form your own where there's no leader. And I feel like, local libraries are often wonderful places to bring writers together into a community. And in my area, living in the Boston-Cambridge area, the opportunities for attending readings and talks and lectures and workshops abound, even mm-hmm. if you're not enrolled in an actual MFA program.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you can get so much out of just going to a panel and hearing writers talk about some aspect of craft or anything having to do with writing.
Yes. Yeah. And seriously, shows like this one, like your radio program, and then the fact that now more and more of these are archived,
mm-hmm.
so they're accessible even if you miss the broadcast. I get so much out of talks I listen to on the radio as well.
Yeah, I agree. I started this show because I wanted my own personal MFA program. Because I couldn't go to one at the time, It's like I'm gonna talk to the people that are gonna have something to teach me, mm-hmm. and hopefully they'll teach others as well that are listening. So yeah, that's interesting. Do you work on more than one project at a time? Do you go in between projects? Because I see that you write nonfiction as well. And are you just solidly in one until it's over, or are you back and forth?
I'm pretty much in one until it's over. And at times when I'm nearing the end of a project, I start to get a little bit anxious about, you know, not knowing what's coming next. But I've had the pleasant experience that usually just when one project is wrapping up, sort of out of, you know, in my peripheral vision, I begin to see something beginning to materialize. So I almost feel as though the inspiration or the ideas have learned to be patient and wait before revealing themselves to me. And I do work better when I can focus intensely on solely one project at a time.
Hmm. How does nonfiction inform fiction, or fiction inform nonfiction for you?
I love the research. And for me, research covers a really broad spectrum of activities, you know, whether it's conducting formal interviews or doing library research or... In my first novel, I have a scene where a raw egg has been left on the stove, and there's a fire. And I wanted to write the scene and describe what happens to the egg when it catches on fire. And I got up from my computer and went into the kitchen and stuck a raw egg on the burner and turned on the gas. And you know, and I got this real charge of excitement out of doing the actual research to see, you know, wouldn't a raw egg explode and stick to the stovetop?
Interesting,
yeah. So whether I'm doing fiction or nonfiction, I really love to throw myself into the research and reporting process. And I think I have learned from practicing the craft of fiction, I've learned a little bit more in nonfiction about borrowing a lot of the techniques we associate with fiction, you know, whether it's characterization or dialogue or setting a scene or moving characters through a scene. These are all things that can be used to good effect in nonfiction, but often we don't think of nonfiction in this way. So I think they have, both genres have so much to offer the other.
Mm-hmm. We are about at the end of our time. I wonder if in ending you could talk just for a minute or so about points in the book when you might have felt stuck or at a place where you just didn't know what was supposed to happen, what was going to happen, or maybe you felt... I don't know, just written out, and how you got through it, what you might have done to go on.
I love how that question acknowledges and presupposes that, of course, there are these moments of being stuck and feeling doubt. So thank you, first of all, for phrasing it that way. I think that does a service to all writers. And I certainly had many such points, but a big one for me was as I neared the end of the book, I began to realize that I wanted to end in what for me was something a little more in the direction of metaphiction than is my customary style. And I was nervous about this. I didn't know if it would fly. And I was really nervous, actually. I felt suddenly like I couldn't end this book. And I called a friend and talked with her and started out the phone call by saying, I don't think I can finish. I don't know what to do. And then I talked and talked and talked, and she said, sounds like you know exactly what to do. And I said, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. And that's what got me through that moment. And I did go ahead and take this little leap of faith and write the end in what was for me a little bit of a rule-breaking manner.
Hmm. So talking it out.
Yeah. Others.
The grief of others is the title. And I so appreciate you taking the time this morning to talk with us.
It's been lovely. Thank you.
You're so welcome. That was Leah Hager-Cohen, and her book is The Grief of Others, published by Riverhead. And there was so much more to talk about, as there always is, it seems. I'm not sure what to do about that. Have her on when the paperback comes out, maybe. Anyway, we're at the end of our time. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. You can check out the podcast at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And what else can I tell you except that we will be back next week with more authors that we find interesting and love. And I hope that you're here with us too. Thanks so much for listening.